then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your bike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's December the 6th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I think this week we'll start with the heavy stuff up front. I should explain that from now on, this podcast is probably going to become a lot more heavy and serious than it has sometimes been in the past. In fact, it's going to get downright grim, not only because we now live in an overt dictatorship where a third world tyrant has appropriated to himself the power to rule by decree and to kill or imprison without trial anyone he wants to, but because of the increasing likelihood that I am now working under a time limit. Now, I know I've mentioned this before, and most of you are probably convinced that I was joking or exaggerating or just batting the breeze, but I'm deadly serious about this Obamacare thing. Within a little over a year, I will be committing a federal felony, specifically income tax evasion, when I do not pay the IRS fine for not purchasing Obamacare, because I can't pay it. While it's true that millions of people will probably be in the same boat as I will be, the fact is that I am who I am. I'm under a microscope, and the minute I break the law, you'd better believe our friends in the silk suits are going to be all over me. Guys, I'm not saying this to be melodramatic or self-dramatizing, or because I'm sitting here quaking in paranoid fear of Obamacare, or because I'm trying to win your sympathy, or anything like that. This is a bona fide situation, and I'm simply explaining to you all that at some point in the future I'm going to have to face it. I think we need to assume that unless they decide to try and scoop me up on something fabricated earlier, within the next year or so, then sometime around May or June of the year 2014, after I file my 2013 income tax return and I can't pay the Obamacare fine, I'm going to be involved in some kind of confrontation with a dictatorship and its tax collectors, which I will lose. Unless my medical problems kick in first, we need to assume that I have approximately 18 months left before this confrontation occurs. Guys, I really, really am not trying to make a big self-serving drama out of this, but from now on, I'm going to be working with a view towards getting done everything that I can get done within the next 18 months, so that if any of you people ever do decide to step forward, you will be able to pick up where I've left off. They're finally starting to release a few details as to how this monstrosity will work, so listen up now. This is the way it's going to work for me, and quite possibly for a number of you as well. Depending on your employer, you may be okay. If you work for some outfit like the Teamsters, or the SEIU, or any unionized company, or if you work for a company that donated large amounts of money to Obama's re-election campaign, or has other ties to the ruling Democrat Party in our wonderful new one-party state, then you will probably be able to keep your present health insurance, because your union or your company, whoever's tight with the Democrats, will have gotten an Obamacare waiver from the White House, exempting them from this mess. Now, these waivers are pretty expensive, and you may end up paying more for your plan or you may not, but you'll more or less get to keep what you've got. The people who are in trouble are companies and employers who didn't pony up to the Democrats, or even worse, those who openly supported Mitt Romney and other Republican candidates. No waiver for them. Already, certain companies, including some high-profile restaurant chains like Papa John's Pizza and the Cheesecake Factory, have started cutting almost all their employees back to 30 hours or less per week, so they're officially considered part-time and the company doesn't have to buy Obamacare for them. So, not only are their wretched employees going to have to be compelled by law to purchase Obamacare, but they're going to have to buy it on a part-time salary. One aspect of Obamacare that will probably affect a lot of us is that from now on, many more millions of white Americans will not have one full-time job, even a minimum wage one, because that would force the employer to pay thousands of dollars a year to buy him Obamacare. Everyone will have two or three part-time jobs with no insurance or bennies at all. So the government will step in and provide things like food stamps and some kind of check, and basically buy these people's votes for the Democrats with EBT cards. That's essentially what happened on November the 6th. That and the massive vote fraud, of course. Anyway, getting back to yours truly, listen up, because some of you might be in this situation as well. Now, because of November 6th, and because there's no chance of repeal now, I am required by law, sometime in 2013, to purchase health insurance from one of these pools of private providers like Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Kaiser Permanente, so forth and so on, that are bundled up together on a state-by-state basis, allegedly to spread the risk. Now, bear in mind, despite the name Obamacare, you're not getting some kind of government health insurance here. You're being forced, through the threat of violence and imprisonment, to buy private insurance at whatever premium the companies care to charge. Now, these private insurers are, in turn, required to take anybody and everybody, including people like me, with one or more serious pre-existing conditions, and going into the time of life when we will start needing a lot of doctoring. Now, these private insurance pools will be forced to operate under or in some relation to Medicaid. Exactly how is not clear yet. Anyone who's ever attempted to get on Medicaid, as I did in Oregon some time ago, unsuccessfully, knows that following Medicaid regulations means that, essentially, blacks and Mexicans and illegal aliens and other Democratic constituencies will either get free medical care or premiums so cheap that, essentially, it's free. I remember the whole long list of 16 or 18 conditions for getting on Medicaid in Oregon, and there was, and presumably still are, only two ways for a white male to qualify. He must be completely disabled or blind. If you're not blind or in a wheelchair and you've got white skin and a dick on you, forget it, Pally. You're going to spend your life savings and mortgage your home to pay for your cancer treatments. And if you don't have any money, then you crawl off in a corner and die. For non-whites and union members and other targeted demographics, Obamacare isn't a disaster. It's a perk. It's a bribe that the Democrats will give to blacks and Mexicans and third worlders once Obama amnesties them by decree, in exchange for their votes on Election Day, which will keep the Democratic Party in perpetual power. Now, this does not apply to me or most of the people listening to this podcast. When, some years ago, I tried, again unsuccessfully, to get on Washington's version of Medicaid, the little black girl sitting behind a desk who turned me down told me, quite unselfconsciously and without thinking, "The thing is, Mr. Covington, men in your demographic aren't supposed to be drawing on these benefits. They're supposed to be paying for them." Now, this means that in their last desperate attempts to make a profit in the final years before the dictatorship wipes out the private health insurance industry altogether, someone in my demographic, as the Sheboon put it, is going to get clobbered. Middle class and middle-aged white people as a whole are going to get clobbered by Obamacare because these companies know that middle-aged and elderly whites now control the last major reserves of privately held wealth in this country. And just like the dictatorship itself, they are going to be clawing at white people's flesh to get at some of that wealth before it all drains away and they become bankrupted by having to pay for blacks and browns who will more or less ride free. And they also get wiped out by having to pay for everybody's pre-existing conditions. Although they have not yet announced the exact Obamacare premium schedules, looks like they're going to do that very quietly and on a state-by-state basis. I don't think people understand yet just how incredibly high the cost of this artificial insurance is going to be as the companies in each state pool desperately try to keep their heads above water. In 2009, when the abomination first passed this abomination, I checked out the Washington State program that they dropped in as Emergency Obamacare via Medicaid so that the dictator could claim that he already had everybody covered. Now, that's the program where if I'd had the money, they would have had to let me join despite my age and my several pre-existing conditions. To get a full coverage policy with a $500 deductible, which would damn near bankrupt me right there, would run me about $16,000 per year. That's roughly $1,400 per month for health insurance. Although, like I say, no one knows exactly how much Obamacare for a 59-year-old white male with pre-existing conditions will cost. My guess is that in a desperate attempt on the part of the insurers to recoup something from the last remaining demographic that's supposed to have any money, middle-aged and elderly white males, my Obamacare premiums will probably be about the same thing once the permanent program's installed. This is where I will end up breaking the law. The law states that I must buy this insurance, just like I am legally compelled to buy car insurance. It doesn't say a damn thing about what they will charge me for it or where in God's name I'm supposed to get an extra $16,000 every year. When I file my federal income tax return in April of 2014, there will be something on the 1040 form or attached to it where I must give the IRS a policy number or an ID number or some kind of proof that I have complied with the law and purchased Obamacare at $16,000 per year or whatever the cost is. Now, if I don't have that, which I won't, then as part of the tax tables where I compute my final tax bill for the year, I will be assessed a fine, which right now appears will be 2/3 of the Obamacare premium. We don't know exactly what that premium will be, but if the cost is the same as it is now, my fine will be something on the order of $10,000, which I also cannot pay. And then I go through the same thing next year and the year after that, and eventually I'll run up quite a tab. Now, that's the brutal stick behind Obamacare. There is no special law about non-payment that could be challenged. The dictatorship uses the IRS as its collection agency. And if you don't pay what the IRS demands, that is already a federal felony. Income tax evasion. I have nothing for them to seize by way of property, and so federal agents will presumably at some point come to my home and arrest me, in essence, for the crime of being poor. Now, that sounds Dickensian, but please bear in mind that we live in an era in which everyone's pretty much lost their minds. And so, yes, they will do it. I have no money for bail, even if any's set, and in any case, presumably my bail conditions would include an order not to access the internet, which is pretty standard nowadays anytime one of us gets pulled into the machine. As I said, this confrontation will probably occur in May or June of 2014. If I delay filing my 2013 tax return, wherein I admit I have no Obamacare up until the last minute, on April the 15th. At some point after that, probably fairly quickly, some of the dictator's armed men are going to come to my door and take me away for income tax evasion. And I presume I won't be coming out any more than Edgar Steele won't be coming out ever again. They may even ship me to Victorville, where I can drink and shower in the cancer-causing toxic waste. So, unless they decide to fabricate something to take me out early, or unless I keel over onto the floor, that gives me roughly 18 months to say what I have to say on here, write what I have to write, and do what I have to do in order to make sure that my work survives me before I will become involved in some kind of unavoidable legal confrontation with the dictatorship, having to do with the fact that I am unable to pull $16,000 out of my ass. Now, I need to prepare myself and you for that eventuality. This is going to mean talking on here over the next few months about some things that many of you will be convinced I shouldn't be talking about in public. Now, you may be right, but if I really do have this limited window of opportunity to pass on the last of my ideas and my vision and my faith in a white homeland, then I need to go ahead and get it done. Now, for those of you who say, come on, Harold, none of this stuff is really going to happen. It's just paranoid bullshit. Well, actually, yes, this or something like it really is going to happen. Check back with me in 6 months after we've gone over the fiscal cliff and you can finally check out the Obamacare premiums you're going to have to pay. Now, some of you skeptics may end up in the cell beside me and Ed down there in Victorville. Remember, like Greg Hood said, just because you're not interested in politics doesn't mean politics isn't interested in you. First music break. This is a song from Sean Davies' Pilgrim album, which I'll be featuring this week. It's from one of the earliest descriptions of Ireland by the Phoenician traders of the Bronze Age.
Here is the city of Gadir, formerly called Tartessus. Here are the pillars of stubborn Hercules. They groan under the hard north wind, but stand fixed in their place. And here rises the head of the mountain chain, whose whole lofty and rocky mass runs chiefly towards the warm south wind. Under the head of this range, the Astrimnic Gulf opens before the inhabitants, in which stand the Astrimnides Islands, widely scattered and rich in minerals, tin and lead. Here is a vigorous people, proud in spirit, skillful at their work, and in their famous skiffs they sail wildly over the torpid gulf and the abyss of the monster-infested ocean. These people have no knowledge of building ships of pine, but a thing to marvel at, they always construct their ships of skins, sewn together, and often in a hide, speed over the vast deep. From thence, it is a 2 days voyage to the sacred island, so the ancients called it. This lies amid the waves, abounding in verdure, and the race of the Ierni, widespread, dwell there. Next, after it, extends the island of the Albiones. Swift my curl speed, its stern turn to there. Hateful my journey on the high seas, sailing from the coast of Alba. The seagulls of Lough Foul before me and behind me, they do not approach my curragh. Miserable is our departure. If all of Alba were mine, from coast to coast, I would rather by far my own place on the gentle plains of Dara.
Tonight I'd like to review a book called Fighting for the Essence. This is a short essay dealing with the ironies of a multiracial state. It talks about multiracialism and multiculturalism as being an environment which ultimately kind of destroys its multiplicity. It talks about how essentially groups act as blocks and how they affect history. It talks about the effect of what it calls an unhealthy monotheism. And one quotation from this essay is, "When a people think they find in other peoples their reason to live and believe, they have fallen into slavery." And I see this so often in people that I know that are always talking about bringing minorities into the system because they essentially act outside of their own self-interest, and they do so seemingly gladly, and it's quite strange and quite unnatural. Now, this pamphlet says that the remedy to the West is really the essential Europe. It talks about an awakening to a non-dualist pagan tradition, and it says that we must play at the game of an ethnostate much as a child plays with toys. A child is very serious in their play, and so we must also be serious about our views. Another quotation is courageous and spontaneous impulse of individuals who rebel against the foreign religion. Now, this pamphlet is not against an organic democracy, but it hopes for what it calls the death of the West, because it is a hope that the real essential European spirit will be reborn. It talks about this spirit as a Greek spirit of being in harmony with nature, seeing the divine in nature. It talks very much against the Americanization of Europe. It talks about stages of mongrelization. First of all, the law tends to enforce ethnic chaos in the first stage, and then we come into a stage where panmixia is viewed as normal. And then in the third stage, the society is entirely given over to non-whites. It says that for us, the essential question is that of our roots. Who are we? And every other question follows suit from that. It says that the paganism that's put forward in this pamphlet by Pierre Krebs is not simply looking back and trying to recreate the past, but it's trying to create a future in which the European spirit is fulfilled. It talks about a need to have a spiritual revolution within ourselves, to try to root out any decadence that may have come about because of being exposed to the system. It talks about detachment, and it says that this withdrawal is not to isolate, but to detach. We detach in order to be in a better position to fight. It talks about artists and intellectuals who lead the path to this spiritual revolution. And it also admits that an ethnostate is necessary to preserve true diversity. So I really found this booklet to be really very clarifying in terms of its worldview. It's really the kind of thing that I've found myself thinking about ever since high school in one way or another, but it puts it forward very eloquently. It's a short read, and it's another book from Arctos. So I really found this very worthwhile, in so much as any book is worthwhile right now. I know that in a lot of ways it restates the problem or redefines the problem, but I would recommend reading it. You know, what can I say? Some people will agree with it and others won't, but I think it's a very fine essay. So I hope you enjoyed my review, and hopefully I'll see you soon. So thank you for listening.
Greetings, comrades. Andy Donner from Seattle here. I'm talking to you today because the NF gets a few requests via email over and over, which really ought to be dealt with in front of the whole RFN audience. As I'm recording this, I ought to be doing something else entirely for the party. But believe it or not, we're not the ogres we sometimes come across as, and we actually do take time to respond to you. We're starting to get an upswing in certain questions, and they're actually good. If they're really critical, I'll respond to the comments on the party website, especially if someone is facing a critical decision. Usually, I prefer to do an RFN submission since anything worth responding to is worth responding to in front of everyone. As I said, I ought to be doing something else entirely right now, and what I'm going to do is cover today something everyone, even those who have been aware of the NF for some time, ought to do for the sake of those in the homeland. I'm not trying to gripe, but it's time for the NF community to take a little responsibility for the quality and frequency of their communications. Now, I'm not trying to deprecate anyone's communications to Mr. Covington or myself, since on more than one occasion, someone emailed something and it got forwarded all over the internet and eventually ended up in one of our email inboxes, which prompted us to review it and send it along to Mr. Covington, who then decided it was important enough to send to the entire NF email list. What I am trying to do is a little bit of spaced repetition and direct especially new listeners to a few resources which will answer most of the questions we get over email on a regular basis. older listeners would do well to review this material, especially those undertaking the migration. I've done some version of this answer over email, party website comment, and the NF forum inside of the last week, so it warrants an RFN submission on grounds of the demand alone. All right, down to business. Let's call this Northwest Front and Northwest Migration 101. The first thing someone needs to do is read everything they can at the party website, especially the Butler Plan and the draft Northwest American Republic Constitution. There is the possibility that some hearing this might not be aware of the Northwest Front, so the party website is northwestfront.org, all one word. Once you're done with the website content, find the Q&A Radio Free Northwest podcast episode. It's RFN number 35, dated September 23rd, 2010. It's 2 hours long, but it's the best listening we can offer someone new, or even someone who's been with us a while but hasn't gone that far back in the podcast, which you should all do at the first available opportunity. If you're more or less on board with the idea of a sovereign, all-white nation in the Pacific Northwest, use the contact page of the party website to request an introduction packet. We'll need your real name and an address you receive mail to. If you can't work up the courage to provide us that, you're not going to get a packet since there's a fair chance it won't be delivered to a fake name. While waiting for your introduction packet from the party, get your hands on at least one of the Northwest Independence novels. I recommend The Brigade despite its length since it is the most comprehensive demonstration of the concept of a significant white resistance. If you're in doubt, read the first chapter since it's a real kick. If you're unable to buy the books, get in touch with someone from the party and we'll email you PDF copies, though you'll likely have to read them on a computer monitor. It can be done. It's how I read all the novels for the first time. Once you get your introduction packet, pore over it with a special focus on the 4th edition Northwest Migration Manual, or the White Book. This is the latest version of such a manual and can be ordered separately at lulu.com. Nearly everything I'm going to say from here on out is found in that book, which is why the party has to periodically repeat such content and direct those interested individuals to such sources. We are not at all unhappy to genuinely handle important and serious questions, but the same things keep coming up at a more and more rapid pace. Not only that, but some of these inquiries, innocently to be sure, imply we have some sort of secret which we only dispense to those who ask about it. We don't. We don't have an inside angle on jobs, and we don't have a magic bullet for the migration. I know our questioners don't mean to make such implications, but understand me here. The answers you're looking for are in the White Book. Once you're done listening to this RFN, pick up a copy and read it. Twice. It will fill you in on everything you want to know. Okay, back to the lesson. After you've got the packet, plan your migration and put it into practice. It will take some time done right, so read the rest of the Northwest Independence novels and listen to the rest of RFN, even just for the entertainment value, though that's not all there is to it by a long shot. Also, get rid of your cable or satellite or whatever television. You never needed it, and it will distract you and cost you money you need to save for the migration. If you've gotten to this point and you're still interested, you need to contact the party about your $10 per month dues. Many of us give more, but the way things are going, we've got little right to ask for more than that from most people. Movements run on people, their time, and their money, and we've got to be honest about it. This brings me to the latest email question we've been sent. Our comrade writes, "Dear Hack, what would you recommend as a sane white nationalist forum with a positive community? What do jobs look like in the homeland? Are there any PLE communities with their heads on straight in the region that have adequate community and intellectual resources to become properly learned on what this thing is all about? Where can I meet quality folks? What kind of entry-level jobs are available in the region? I don't know where to start and I'm afraid of making a misinformed choice." Okay, comrade, I'll take the more important question first. Follow the advice and instructions I've given, and then when you're ready to make a scouting trip, contact the party about the various primary settlement areas and we'll direct you as well as we can. We're not really doing the PLE thing since they don't do anything outside of creating communities. That's important, sure, but the PLE types in the movement don't seem to want anything involving actual change, so we're more or less at odds, sadly. You're right to want to be educated, but the best way to do that is through books. The Northwest Front has a reading list which is more or less the old NSWPP's reading list, and it's on Mr. Covington's Thought Crime blog. Start there and use a website like alibris.com to acquire the more obscure texts. I did a lot of reading off of that list in the year it took me to migrate, and I recommend that resource to everyone interested. Quality folks, sadly, are a little hard to come by. The comrades I've met in the Seattle and Portland areas are quite good, and I can safely recommend their company. I've met a handful of others from around the homeland, and I can also endorse them for being quality people. The party used to run a public contact email list, but some negative elements started misusing it and we were forced to stop. I've enjoyed meeting everyone on that list I've been able to, but such a resource isn't available any longer. The movement is full of very damaged individuals, and in all fairness, that isn't always their fault. We've had a lot of disappointing efforts and downright evil and demented leaders, which have contributed to the baggage many old movement hands are carrying around. Movement leaders outside the Northwest Front are to the point where they're either playing a game or competing for donation dollars and won't allow any discussion of such matters. So I can't really recommend a white nationalist message board simply because discussion of actual solutions is always off limits. We have our own message board, but I can't recommend you spend much time at all on any message boards, since that's time and effort you should have been using towards your migration. And lastly, on the job situation, the White Book covers it as much as a written resource can. I'll go over it here since I get this question a lot from new incomers. There are jobs in the metropolitan areas for anyone capable of work. Each rural town is unique, and without advice from someone there, I can't remark. I've written more than a few emails to those trying to organize a scouting trip or their migration, and I've gotten a mixed reaction. Some people, especially foreigners, were just looking for a general overview and were really grateful for the level of detail I went into. Others are a little more intimidated by my feedback, and perhaps with some good reason. Mr. Covington once remarked that people migrate, and they do, but very rarely to the headquarters area, since that means we get to place demands on them, and we will. As I said, there are jobs in the metropolitan areas like Portland and Seattle. To a lesser extent, we can include Spokane, Boise, Eugene, and maybe a few smaller cities in that list. Unless you are bringing a very specific skill or have your own business that the world can't do without, which admittedly is very possible, and I'm sure at least some of you fit this description exactly, you aren't going to do well in a rural environment and you need to head to a city. In fact, you'll almost have to, since coming here and failing to have employment soon enough will seriously damage you and the party. Many potential migrants, and even those on their scouting trip, do everything they can to avoid the cities. I understand that. I'm in the middle of downtown Seattle, and in all honesty, it's not all that different from any other big city, though, to be sure, the exact mix of minorities isn't the same. Outside of the neighborhoods surrounding the downtown area, it's white. And there are jobs here. Or in Portland. Or in other cities as you see fit. There are huge corporations in the big cities, and those corporations mean all sorts of money flying around the areas their employees live in. That money flying around means entry-level jobs. If you have a skill set of some sort, you'll do better in the cities, unless you know differently than I do, which admittedly is entirely possible. If you don't have a skill, you'll have to hit up the cities. I'm sorry to say I can't do much more for you other than this, since I haven't done any entry-level work in many years, other than a few months during the start of the Obama Depression. And to get those jobs, you just have to be here. In response to the comrade-specific question, I can confidently say we have any sort of entry-level job you're willing to attempt, at least in Seattle. Should you be curious about other locales, please let the party know and we'll do what we can to put you in touch with someone capable of answering that question. I have to admit straight up that the party talks out of both sides of its mouth on the issue of where to land when you migrate. Sure, cities aren't the greatest places to live for whites, but we need people in them. I understand not everyone will be willing to relocate into a city, but at some point or another we're going to have to attempt real units, and not the skeleton-like satellites of our barely staffed headquarters group. This is as much your responsibility as it is mine. If we don't start coming into cities, we're not going to be within half an hour of each other, and we can't do what we're migrating in order to do. I spoke several weeks ago on RFN about what Northwest migration is and what it is really for. Let's keep that chat in mind. Some potential migrants we've met on scouting trips have skills which actually require they be located outside of metropolitan areas, and they're obviously taking care of their own business. However, we're starting to see a trend of potential migrants avoiding the cities, though, and that's not altogether unheard of. I admit the cities have their issues, but they're where we have to start since they're where the population is. If we don't ever form a real base, we can't start phase one of the Butler Plan, and we're screwed as a race, then. I talk a lot about accepting responsibility, but now I'm talking about accepting full responsibility. Think of this as an extension on my rant of coming home all the way. Come home all the way to where you're really needed. I understand that's just not for everyone, and I fully accept that. It's not wrong to go where you need to go, but please don't discount the cities. Okay, I'll lay off that appeal, since it's mostly my griping, and I've done enough of it. It just seems like many migrants are looking for a reason to avoid the cities, and at some point I have to try to put a stop to it. Since I've admitted to griping, I'll make a different appeal now. I've said we get a lot of these questions that could be solved easily by reading the party website, the white book, or the novels. It's not wrong to ask these questions, no, but I'm sure none of the people sending these requests would be willing to respond to the volume of email the party gets. I shouldn't gripe too much since I deal with very little of it, but as I said before, I should be doing something else right now. I realize the people considering migration are much more important, but at some point something's got to give. We get migrants, sure, but almost none of them will come where they are needed, and most end up having little effect. That's not a dig at our people outside Seattle or Portland at all, but it's an observation about things in general. All our other comrades I've met are quality, and Mr. Covington has nothing but positive remarks about those I've not met. None of them should be downcast about not being here, and I suppose I might be talking out of both sides of my mouth again. That's sort of how it goes around here. But the point stands. There's a lot of work to be done, and I'd like to see the NF community take a little more responsibility about figuring things out for themselves. I did the things I'm telling you all to do before I contacted the party for the first time, and as a result, I didn't need to inquire after every little thing. True, I had a better idea of where I needed to move and what I needed to do, but that doesn't affect the situation in a material way. It's natural for those of you trying to migrate to ask for advice, and none of you have done anything wrong. But I feel like it's appropriate to point out we haven't got anything to tell you we haven't already said in public. That's not meant to put you off, but we are about to pass the breaking point of hours in the day where we can get things done. Mr. Covington is able to do nearly all of the party work, but the rest of us are employed and we haven't the time we need to do more at the moment. There's nothing wrong with curiosity or genuine desire to be involved or even needing to ask questions of the party directly, especially if you're new. I've already said on Radio Free Northwest that I used to do these things myself. I composed some really long, long emails that turned out to be pretty useless. Sure, we get plenty of useful emails all the time, but it would help if everyone took the initiative and went through the resources I brought up. After that, someone is either going to migrate or not. Those still needing to ask questions of the party are more equipped to do so, since they're on the same page as the rest of us. I think I'm going to have to make this podcast episode my canned answer anytime I need to answer emails about the party in general, since it's probably better digested via audio than a form letter. Recently, we've had a clown pestering us over Facebook wherein he asks for meetings and all that stuff. I always like to have people get their introductory packet and read over its material before we do a face-to-face, since they get to know what they're involving themselves in, and they can ask questions based on what they read. This packet came back, and the guy requesting it has gone dark. Mr. Covington and I have repeatedly told you all to use real names and information when trying to get in touch with us. I've got a new rule. If you're unable to get a packet in the mail, I don't need to meet with you. From now on, I won't set up face-to-face meetings with people who haven't read their packets to my satisfaction, such as being able to tell me what's in it. Based on some of the garbage comments on the RFN episodes we've seen lately, you know, the ones that generate heat rather than light, as Mr. Covington says, some of you haven't gotten your packets yet, and you need to get on that. Hail victory, comrades.
Some of you may recall that I spent some time living in the Isle of Man, which is an island in the Irish Sea between Ireland and Wales, originally founded as a Viking colony, and which has the oldest continually existing legislature in the world, Tynwald, which was founded by the early Norse settlers. Now, in the center of the Isle of Man is a big mountain called Snaefell. When St. Columba arrived in the island to Christianize the place, he supposedly tangled with a local druid named Brecon, and the two of them fought a magical duel. Brecon went up on top of Snaefell, and he conjured up this huge beast or thing that was nothing but three legs encased in armor, and it went rolling down the mountain towards St. Columba, where the saint either vaporized it with a prayer to the Lord, or else it smushed him, depending on which version of the story you believe. To this day, the emblem on the Manx flag is that same three-legged thingummy, which looks almost like a swastika. It's called a triskelion. This is from Sean Davies' Pilgrim album, and it's a piece about this famous magical duel called Brecon and Columba. The classic definition of stupidity is doing the same thing over and over again while expecting a different result each time. I've just stated, in a nutshell, the entire history of the American white nationalist movement. Now, this essentially is what the white man has been doing for the past 50 years in our pathetic efforts to resist racial and cultural extinction at the hands of the Jews. We have taken the attitude of, if you build it, they will come. We build it, or at least an approximation of it, and they never come. It hasn't worked. Nothing that we have tried has worked. I won't say that we need to discard the entire last 70 years or so of our subculture's history altogether, or that everything we've done since 1954 has been a total waste, because it hasn't been, not quite. There are some lessons to be learned, if only negative ones. Now, I'm not attempting sarcasm or humor when I say that the past 50 years or so provide us with a full, complete, and comprehensive model of what not to do and how not to do it. Now, if we are to have any hope of securing the existence of our people and a future for white children, then all this stuff we've been doing since any of us can remember, we need to stop doing it and try something else. When you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you do is to stop digging. White people are no longer capable of responding in the way we want them to respond to all of the standard Rotary Club-style tactics and democracy-based strategies that we've been using. Problem is not what we've been doing. The problem is who we are. Yet since giving up is inadmissible, we have to find some way to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. We have to take highly inferior human material and create a genuine national independence movement here in the Pacific Northwest. We have to do it because it is the last chance that white people will ever have to survive on this North American continent. Now, here are some just general points that we need to start with. First off, the present system is absolutely corrupt and utterly beyond redemption. In any event, it should now be obvious to anyone with two brain cells to rub together that only a total and complete change in the entire order of society from ground up can suffice to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. The short word for this is revolution. We must seek total change, not any kind of reform. There was never any point in participating in elections under the old two-party system, and even less now that we have a one-party system. There is no point in attempting to gain entrance into the power structure of our racial enemy. We simply will not be allowed in, period. End of story. And we will be destroyed or rendered neuter if we persist in attempting to work within the system. The Ron Paul experience demonstrates the futility of this. Dr. Paul has a large and enthusiastic following, both internet and real world. He's raised millions of dollars in donations, and so he has the resources to compete with the establishment's candidates. He has an intelligent and workable program, and he's personally charismatic. In short, although Paul is not by any stretch of the imagination a racist, he has all of the things that we claim we are waiting to fall out of the sky for one of ours. Oh, if only we could raise some money, if only we had a good media guy for a leader, oh, yada, yada, yada. I'm sure most of you have heard this refrain at one time or another, so you can fill in the blanks. Well, Ron Paul does have the money and the media presence and all the things we claim to want, and he has been royally screwed for his trouble. The establishment media treats him like a crank. They laugh at him and deride him, exclude him from most of the presidential primary debates, and spread stupid smears and slanders about him, including, by the way, bogus connections with us. Now, when it came time to vote, they simply stole all his votes from New Hampshire on. They banned him from the rest of the debates, and that was that. Ron Paul is a genuine outsider, and outsiders in this society are never allowed to get anywhere near the levers of power. Period. End of story. The power structure and the people who control it will not listen to us. Why should they? They've been ignoring us for generations, and they've suffered no adverse consequences, so why should they not continue to ignore white people and do whatever the hell they want for their own benefit and for the Jews who pay them? It is the system itself that threatens our racial and cultural existence. And it is the system itself that has to go. Change cannot be accomplished solely through education. We need to quit using education as an excuse to evade our racial duty. It's true that a necessary prerequisite for revolutionary change is that the white man's collective thinking, his knowledge of the nature of the world around him, and his perception of people and events must be altered. It's also true that it will be a large part of the mission of the party to carry out this function through propaganda, some of which will be educational in nature, but with all due respect to the late Dr. Pierce, propaganda and education is a means to an end, not an end of itself. Now, we've been using education as yet one more fig leaf to avoid incurring personal risk and doing the heavy lifting that we all know must eventually be done by someone. Pardon my euphemisms, but since November the 6th, you're going to be hearing a lot more Aesopian language on here. Now, we must understand that there will be no escape from our profound moral duty to relocate to the homeland as soon as it can be accomplished and to confront the Zionist state when we're there and transfer power from the hands of that state into our own hands. The question is how difficult this transfer of power will be, and that depends on a wide set of circumstances that have not yet made their appearance. Now, when real men want to change something, they change it. They don't worry about whether anyone will let them change things. Real men do not ask anyone's permission. They just do it. They don't ask permission of the people whose self-interest will be affected. Of course, those who currently hold wealth and power and position in this putrid society will never voluntarily surrender it. No one ever does. Now, these people have devoted their lives and careers to doing harm to you and yours. Their desires or opinion in the matter should be disregarded. The people who hold power and wealth in this society use it solely for themselves, to feed their own gargantuan and perverted appetites and egos. And in doing so, they abuse their power and wealth to do harm. They are bad people. They have no rights and deserve no consideration at your hands. Why would you allow someone to do you harm on the grounds that they have rights? That's just silly. It's a rule that bad people with money and power made up to protect themselves from being punished for their behavior. Now, we cannot do this by calling a radio talk show host and bitching, or by tapping on a computer keyboard, or by going into a silly little booth and pulling an electronic lever to cast a vote that the Diebold Corporation may or may not decide to count or alter at will. If we want change, then we change things. Effectively speaking, we're starting over from scratch. You guys are really not going to want to hear this one, but it's unfortunately true. Now we have to begin laying the kind of foundation-building groundwork that should have been done two generations ago, and which should have been completed in the last generation. The white nationalist movement in America, separatist or otherwise, has no infrastructure of any kind remaining. We're going to have to work on projects and things that should have been done in the 1960s, but which were never done because our self-proclaimed leaders were mostly frauds and incompetents. We must always bear in mind just how badly dysfunctional and damaged white people are, how shallow and short-sighted their political thinking is, how seriously impaired white people's ability to understand the consequences of their actions has become, and how urgently white people are possessed of the American-instilled desire for instant gratification, both material and emotional. Look, I'm sorry to be such a downer, but what can I tell you? This is the real world. We must never forget that in American white people, we are dealing very largely with a group of adolescents who never completely grew up, who have no concept at all of personal responsibility for their behavior, and who have become extremely neurotic and unstable through trying to survive and exist in a profoundly unnatural world. It's not most white people's fault that we are the way we are. We've been socially engineered like that, but the fact remains that we are the way we are, and we disregard that reality at our peril. Another thing that's going to be necessary is for us to remove the taboo on discussion of direct action to bring about social and political change, hence my Northwest novels. We will never be able to implement a solution when the time is right if we tremble in terror even to discuss the only possible thing that we can do in order to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. We also need to be keenly aware of the practical, day-to-day realities of our situation. We are a persecuted minority. We have no power of any kind, and the dictatorship can pretty much use any pretext they want to do whatever they want with us. Nothing can be accomplished until we achieve square one. I define square one as follows. Number one, secure premises, by which I mean a base of operation from which I and others, if necessary, can do media interviews and incur public exposure without finding an eviction notice taped on the door the next morning. Neither I nor anyone else can act as a public spokesman or lead anything, fearlessly or otherwise, if we're living in our car. Number two, the party needs a small staff of reliable Class A people who are physically present at my side, not hiding behind computers hundreds of miles away. It will be necessary for us to build communities of white nationalists who live within half an hour's drive of one another. Number three, the party is going to have to locate at some point a sum of startup capital to get the effort going and to acquire necessary plant and facilities. A lot of the 90s.com started in garages, true, but usually there was also a loan in there somewhere, even if it was only from Uncle Joe indulging his computer geek nephew. At some point, the checkbooks are going to have to be talked or forcibly pried open, but that's a subject for another time. Okay, I've bloviated long enough in this segment, I think. Back to Sean Davey. This is A Walk in the Ocean from The Pilgrim. Thank you. I speak a lot on this show about the issue of character, our character. And one of our people's many common problems along that line isn't so much a question of poor morals or weakness as it is that we're slow. It takes us so long as individuals to learn wisdom. Probably that's because we have no remaining tradition or culture of white or Western civilization anymore like they used to have in Europe, and in a few places they still have. Americans and Canadians are raised on Ronald McDonald and South Park and Xbox these days. Now, we have some really great people associated with the NF, don't get me wrong. Intelligent, knowledgeable, dedicated, in most cases willing to put their money where their mouth is and help out. But I'm afraid that there is some truth to the generalization that the better people among us, and indeed among any white nationalist group, are very largely in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. It's like the old Amish proverb goes, we grow too soon old and too late smart. Now, sometimes I really wonder what some of these older guys were doing back in their teens and 20s and 30s. Okay, in some cases, they were doing the right things, marrying and having families and working jobs, but in a lot of other cases, when I make inquiries, I find that they were basically doing just what white boys have been encouraged to do with their young lives for the past few generations. They were just dicking off in various ways. And it wasn't until they turned about 42 and started having the kind of problems that middle-aged white men start to experience about then that they suddenly woke up out of their consumer fog or their Heineken fugue or whatever, and they started to actually notice what was going on around them, and they started asking questions and looking for answers as to what, why, and above all, who is responsible for the fact that they're now 42 and screwed. Okay, now that's very much to their credit, since most white boys never notice what's going on around them or ask any questions or demand any answers. But we have to start lighting some fires to make sure that this process begins at a much younger age, like high school, say. Now, I've said before that revolution is a young man's game. We're not going to change this filthy world we live in by charging the barricades in our wheelchairs and walkers. Ask the Tea Party how that's worked out for them. One of the things we have to start doing is shifting the median age of our better and more active contacts and readers and listeners downward. Okay, we're starting to get through. A lot of the guys I hear from these days inquiring about migration are pretty young. I'd say the NF is probably the youngest and most female of all the few remaining tendencies in the white nationalist movement. But we have to speed this process up, accelerate the learning curve, and start deliberately targeting younger white people, girls as well as boys. Now, one of the biggest problems that the white right has always had, and we saw this with the Tea Party, is that it's a movement of geriatrics. Like Commander Rockwell described them 50 years ago, people who don't want to save their race, they only want to save their money. In most cases, it's pretty clear that the reason these geezers are involved is they don't want Obama stealing their life savings. Okay, fine, that's fair enough. But we need to remember that young white people don't have any life savings yet to steal. Now, why do you think those Occupy idiots are all so young? Well, one reason is that they're 20 years old and already loaded down with $100,000 in student loan debt, and the Democrats have promised to pay off or wipe out their student loans. Simple bribery to buy votes. That's what Democrats do. Now, the point I'm getting at is that we can't use bribery to recruit young white people. The Democrats have all the money, and so they've already cornered that market. Now, since the NF can't offer much in the way of material gains, we will have to appeal to the natural idealism of youth. As much as I dislike the fact, we have one tool that allows us something like access to the mass of our own people, and that's the Internet. We need to figure out where on the Internet the young white people hang out, and we need to go there and somehow persuade or lure them to northwestfront.org or northwestfront.net, and we have to get the Northwest message in front of them. Rub their noses in it. Somehow we have to make them look, make them listen, and make them start to think, which of course is what they've been raised from birth not to do. Now, this is why I was so up in arms last spring when Facebook started a major campaign to sweep all white nationalism off their site. Granted, Facebook sucks in 5011 different ways. Yes, it's run by Jews. Yes, the secret police use it as a mine of information. Blah, blah, blah. We'll take all that as read. But the fact is that whether we like it or not, this is where the young white people are hanging out now. One of the places anyway. and we have to maintain access so that we can somehow, by hook or crook, get those young white people to click on that link to northwestfront.org. We have to be on Facebook because that's where our target audience is. We need to find other places where our target audience hangs out and go for those young white kids like a pack of piranhas. We need to intrigue them, outrage them, titillate and amuse them, heckle them, anything to get their young cyber asses to northwestfront.org so that at least they will know that we are here. Once that seed is planted, and once they start going through life and experiencing all the problems that young white kids are going to experience, they will be back. Look, I'm not happy with the fact that we have thousands of listeners to this podcast every week who do nothing except log on, listen to the show, and then click away to play games or whatever until it's time to listen again next week. You shouldn't be sitting behind that stupid keyboard. You should be packing the moving van and getting your pale little asses up here to the homeland where you're supposed to be. But if you won't do that, for Christ's sake, will you at least devote some time every week to letting our own people know that we are here? You know, a computer is not a television set. You don't have to just sit and watch it. It's interactive. You can post, you know. www.northwestfront.org or www.northwestfront.net. Those links need to be appearing all over the internet, anywhere a young white boy or girl might see them, thousands of times every week. Now, you remember how I once pointed out that if the 5,000 regular weekly listeners we have would just kick in $10 a month, we'd have our whole problem solved? Okay, and most of you have made it clear that you prefer the 12-pack of cheap domestic beer that $10 will buy. But what if all of you 5,000 people were to post the link to northwestfront.org in some place where white people would see it, say, 4 times every week? Now that's 20,000 links all over the internet. How many new people would actually go to the party website and learn that the Northwest Front exists? Well, I don't know. I know that there are whole advertising and marketing companies and government departments who do studies trying to figure out what motivates the billions of people on the internet to go to the particular sites they go to every day. I don't pretend to understand the process, but it's something we need to start learning. And 20,000 posted links per week sounds to me like a pretty good start to going viral. Come on, guys. If you won't come to the homeland, can you at least do this for me? It will take you, what, 10 seconds to post that link 4 or 5 times a week? That's less than a minute of your time I'm asking for. Our stat counter tells me where our visitors are coming from, the referring link. There are thousands of us, for Christ's sake, listening to this program. Let's see what you can do, okay? Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.